From the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette, this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We appreciate you joining us on the show this month. And if ever you have a question you'd like to make sure gets to the program, email that to ask@wbaa.org or tweet your question at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, we're taping this on the eve of the Purdue men's basketball team playing its game in the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament. Are you on your way to Boston after we're done here?
I'm probably not going to get there tomorrow night. I have a couple other major commitments. I made the first two games, and after we win tomorrow night, I'll go watch us make the Final Four on Sunday. But I have a conflict of duties that I think is going to probably cause me to miss. Sometimes I think they play better when I'm not there. It feels that way, but I'm with them all the way, and so proud. We already were, and then the way the team has handled the bad luck of Isaac's injury, the way Coach Painter has resolutely said that Isaac's future comes first, things like that, I think it just adds to what's already been a tremendous contribution they've made to the Purdue basketball legacy.
Well, we'll see if we're talking about even bigger basketball news when we do this show next month. Let's move on to some other things. There's a lot to cover this month. You've gotten final approval from the Higher Education Commission since we last spoke for buying Kaplan University and starting Purdue Global. I wanted to ask you about the tone of the approval process, because it was very interesting to me. I had a conversation with Indiana's Higher Education Commissioner Teresa Lubbers a year ago, and I thought that her response to me was very similar to the response you got from the Higher Education Commission, which was one of trying to encourage experimentation, trying to say, we're going to let them try this, but we'll kind of be watching as they do it. Did you get that feeling of that sort of encouraging experimentation model as you went through this whole thing?
Very much so on the encouragement side. The Higher Learning Commission has stated, quite apart from our particular case, that they recognize that trying to foster innovation in higher ed is part of their mission. It's in their old strategic plan, I think, that they've published. And so we think our application fit squarely into that, and appreciate their green light. By the time this airs, Stan, the transaction will have closed. Purdue Global will be officially in business. The first 100-plus Purdue staff have already applied or started the application process to become Purdue Global students. These are hardworking people who are part of our Purdue family now who didn't finish their degrees and now have a way to do it. And so their enthusiasm is pretty infectious. We're ready to go, and
We've talked a little as we've gone through this process about the risks that may or may not be involved in this. And, of course, Purdue is a taxpayer-supported entity. And I wondered if you thought that especially big Research One universities like yours should maybe take more risk, even if it's at the, you know, sure, sometimes you're going to succeed, sometimes you're going to fail. But do you think there's enough risk like this generally that is taken?
Very interesting question, and probably not. And higher ed has been in a pretty comfortable rut for a long time, much of it. I've been sharing with so many people the Chronicle of Higher Education's new 170, I think, page report about the adult student, the unmet need, the great obligation. This is the Chronicle, really the Bible of establishment higher ed, recognizing that we need new initiatives here, that this is an important societal goal and an opportunity, but really a responsibility for higher ed. Well, that's exactly what Purdue Global is aimed at, that adult whose life got in the way, as they say, and now is looking for a chance that fits with work with family and other obligations to improve themselves and get the degree they didn't get before.
So based on the fact that there is some risk if this thing somehow does go sideways, you know, risk of millions of dollars possibly, how do you quantify success as you go forward? What measures do you have in place to say these are the numbers we're looking at to know whether you're achieving your aims?
Well, we'll measure success as we do here based on the success of our students. And if large numbers of students are persisting to graduation successfully, adding to their credentials and their prospects in life, that's the measure that'll matter most to us. We've discussed before from a financial standpoint, this thing is pretty risk-free to Purdue. We've structured it that way.
Well, unless I suppose you break the agreement before some official time date passes.
Yeah, this really won't happen, I don't think. You know, you're quite right, however. Some of the other universities that have tried their own forays into digital education, some have spent tens of millions of dollars and got nowhere. And that was watching their struggles was one reason that we decided that if we could partner or acquire these skills from people who had already refined them and road tested them successfully, that would be a lot better. The greatest risk we could have taken, I think, would be to try to build this capability from scratch. And those that tried, some of them were the richest universities in the country, and they may not miss $50 million, but we would.
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. Remember that you can get your questions on this program by emailing news@wbaa.org or ask@wbaa.org. You can tweet your questions too @WBAA News on Twitter. I wanted to take just a brief moment and address a kerfuffle, probably making a mountain out of a molehill recently, and just give you a moment to address it because we haven't reported on it here in the public broadcasting sphere, and I hope we'll put it to bed after this. But I'm not going to apologize for the media coverage that happened because I think it's kind of not the sort that we engage in here in public radio or at WBAA, frankly. I will say, though, I think it's been unfortunate that some of the opinion-based pieces have been out there, which have echoed what I can only call a muckraking website, and then referred to Purdue as putting a ban on the word man or forms of it in this online writing lab guide that your College of Liberal Arts maintains. I guess we should start by noting that the online writing lab referred to by the name Owl as by some notes that these suggestions that are out there have actually existed in some form since 1975, and so anyone who calls themselves a journalist and is doing a story on this guy, I think, is missing at least the timeliness angle of it, to say nothing of the fact that I feel like the word ban is designed to get clicks and not to address what actually is going on here. Do you agree?
Well, if I understand the question, I think I do agree. You know, that when you get away from WBAA and a few other places, there's a lot of inaccurate journalism. Some of it, as people like to say these days, fake. News floating around with fewer and fewer checks on the process than we once had when most such information flowed through, for instance, newspapers who had editors who fact-checked and so forth. There's a lot less of that these days. So you do get, in this case, it was inaccurately reported. You know, it's over. We've been able to, at least those people, and there were a lot of them who were upset by what they had heard or thought they saw on the website and got in touch. We've been able to get back to all of them, and I hope now it's behind us.
You wrote a letter to the campus community that came out on the day that we're taping this, where you said one positive thing that came out of this was that it's going to cause the College of Liberal Arts to make sure that it puts a little more oversight on the guidelines and what. Yeah. And I also thought, in the last year to 18 months, where we've had the Me Too movement and things like that, where we've talked a lot about closing the gaps in gender equity, it seems to me that maybe this is a way that we can show, hey, look, there are guidelines out there that say that even in our writing, that a reminder that we can do things, small things at least, to say, you know, let's say firefighter instead of fireman or something like that, that could be a positive outcome of this.
Oh, I think we want it to remain a valuable resource to those who are searching for suggestions or guidance about everything from word choice to punctuation. And something that's going to be seen by that many people needs to have a level of oversight, and the college is going to up its game in that respect. That's a good thing.
Do you have any sense of changes that might be made due to that oversight?
That's up to them, really. But I think again, we want it to be a neutral and valuable resource to people, and not a subject of controversy in its own right, and I think maybe now it will be.
Lastly, just sort of off the cuff, if Tucker Carlson asks you to come on his show, is this are you going to reconsider?
They did, and I didn't have any interest in doing that. You know, the problem, of course, is that people who are trying to generate attention, cover ratings, clicks, as you said. In trying to correct records, you can somehow just re-perpetuate or perpetuate the story that is best to die a natural death.
Let me talk about some other appearances you've made on national news recently. You talked to Fox and CNBC about some education issues, and they started asking you about steel tariffs, too, based on your time as the OMB director and in a couple of different White Houses. How did you deal with that? How did you decide to engage on that topic when you were on those shows?
Well, it's live television. You have to say something. You know, we've talked before, Stan, about the fact that I try to weigh one by one these invitations as they come, turn down more than we accept. But when I have an opportunity to sit in front of a screen that says Purdue in 20 places and to, I hope, raise our recognition a little bit around the country, I see that as one responsibility of the job. So, as you said, the invitation was to come on and talk about things higher ed. Actually, that one, I believe, was about some of my comments about basketball in our Division I.
Which I think was like the last thing you covered in that conversation.
Yeah. Well, this is life in the media. You know, you're in charge of what we talk about here, and they're in charge when you agree to come on their show. So that was the news of the day. They were asking basically every guest. Having served as governor of the number one steel state for the 8 years preceding this assignment, I knew a little bit about this, and I tried to answer in a fairly neutral way. I said, and it's true, that I had visited with some economists here at Purdue. Always get our name out there when I can. And then I simply made the factual report that there would be very significant negative impacts, even in the number one steel state, which happens to be number one in RVs, number two in autos. Top manufacturing state as a percent of total product, all that. And so I hope I gave a factual and I think accurate answer. And then we got back to the subjects that they had invited me on originally to talk about.
One of the things I've noticed in some of the recent appearances is you've talked about the dysfunction in Congress and some of the chaos that you said is now just the order of the day in the White House, which you said has been different from the White Houses you served in. And it's kind of putting you in a position to criticize the Republican establishment. And I wondered, is that difficult for you as somebody who is still very popular, at least within the Indiana Republican Party? And I get the sense outside of Indiana as well. Do you feel like that's putting you in a rough spot at all?
No, I try really to avoid the subject altogether. I think I'm pretty scrupulous in not ever making partisan comments pro or con. Once in a while, a forum, an interview that I'm a part of verges into this territory, but I try to be as discreet and objective about it as I can. I think we're living up to that so far.
on to other things. We've talked on this program a number of different ways about Purdue trying to help the finances of its graduates, whether it's through student debt or other programs. I wanted to ask you about a program that's going on actually at another Indiana school. DePauw University is starting this thing where it will, and I'm going to quote from their website now. It says, provide an entry-level professional opportunity or additional semester tuition-free if students don't have a job or they're not in grad school within 6 months of graduating. And I was wondering, does this sound like a workable thing for a larger university to do? Is it something that a Purdue might be able to consider, or does it become an issue of scale somewhere in there?
Well, there definitely would be a challenge to try to do it at a school our size as opposed to theirs. I was glad you drew it to my attention. I hadn't heard about it before. We'll have a look at this as we anything new. You were asking about innovation before. Higher ed's in very bad need of it. So good for DePauw for coming up with this new approach. Our employment rate, which counts both those who go to jobs, those who go to grad school, those who might go to the military, but is very, very high, well over 90%, just like theirs is. So we're not dealing with as big a problem as maybe some other schools might, either of us. But all I'll say is we'd look at it. I mean, for the moment, I think we want to keep concentrating on improving our career counseling, maybe extending that back earlier in a student's time here, help them think through the directions they want to go, make sure that then they can shape their curriculum to that.
Do you think the idea of making it a guarantee is problematic?
Yeah, well, I don't know, problematic, but it I'd like to know a lot more about how they're going to do it. What I think I read said they'd give them an extra semester of tuition free.
Right.
Interesting, but, you know, to study what? Does that solve the problem? My guess is for now we've got the more improvement we can make to what we think is a pretty good system of career counseling, career placement. And at some point, it becomes the student's responsibility to go earn that first job. We're just going to do all we can to help them.
I wanted to ask you one quick question about the recently completed legislative session. When you were governor, you were loath to call special sessions. Eric Holcomb, who learned a lot from you, has asked for one for this year. And obviously those things are funded by taxpayer money, some of which might otherwise go to higher education or things like that. What's your opinion? Do you think the state needs a special session this year?
Well, I'm never going to second guess a successor, any of them. And I'm not close enough to know. You do remember correctly. You know, when our team arrived, special sessions were rather conventional. They'd had a bunch of them. And I said, as a general principle, I don't like that. We ought to be able to get the work done in the time available. And we had a lot. We had very, very big agendas, certainly in the early years and really every year. But we were lucky enough to be able to get them finished on time, occasionally a day or two early. But that doesn't mean I was glad we broke the pattern where it was becoming, I thought, too accepted. Well, if we don't finish on time, okay, we'll just have another special session. I was glad we broke that pattern. That doesn't mean you should never do it. And these are, I know they've got some big issues that the governor would like to move on now, not wait a year.
You're listening to Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. Email questions at any time to ask@wbaa.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. You came out recently and you said Purdue might be looking at what to do with the Wi-Fi internet access in its classrooms because you've done some looking and you're finding apparently that there's a lot of Netflix streaming going on where people might otherwise be taking chemistry notes or things like that. How do you decide, especially when, gosh, students are so connected to their electronic devices, it seems they practically have them implanted anymore. How do you decide whether to make such a decision, which would be, I think, hugely controversial if it happened?
We can only decide with the help of faculty and students. That's exactly why we raised the question. The starting point is better information. This came as brand new information to almost everybody outside our IT shop. You know, it started with some complaints which were growing about the inability to get on the Wi-Fi, even in class, or slow a service. And then there's a separate issue in the evening hours. Sometimes we heard from students who said, I wanted to do my homework and there's something wrong with the Wi-Fi. Well, there's nothing wrong with the Wi-Fi. It's just being overwhelmed by the escalation of demand. And so it started with service problems. And then as we've looked more closely, we were beginning to see what's causing them. Now, all we've done so far is tried to share that information broadly, starting with the Faculty Senate and we visited with the student leadership, and we're going to keep doing that. And I think this is a classic example of something you want to try to determine in a collaborative fashion. Most students I've talked to about the classroom situation feel something ought to be done. They do say it's a distraction, and they certainly don't like it if they're trying to access something academic and the screen's jumping or it's a very slow response. So we want to approach it very, very carefully. You know, we're pretty open-minded folks around here, but there probably is a better situation than the one we have now. We certainly want the service to be first rate, and there may be ways that improve the classroom experience, even as they moderate the demand and the cost that we're experiencing.
Purdue is not a school that mandates students to have laptops like some schools do, although it is suggested as a good tool to have with you. And in some ways, that puts you in a spot where you're saying, hey, we want you to be able to use this technology. And then you were saying at the same time, maybe we're going to decide which websites can be accessed from which internet nodes in a classroom or something like that. So there's this kind of push and pull between those two things.
Right. There's every kind of opinion on this. We have a lot of faculty now I'm talking to who ban the use of electronics in their classroom now.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Make students take physical notes.
Yes, or at least certain types of electronics, just because they think it's detracting somehow from the education that's supposed to be going on. Others say we couldn't get along without it. But I do think that in general, people agree that if a student is going to be doing something completely non-academic, watching a movie or playing a game, then don't come to class and do it in a way that might distract those around, and does distract those around you, and frankly is not very respectful of the professor and so forth.
I wanted to come back to a topic we mentioned a couple of shows ago. You mentioned that Purdue, by necessity, is going to have to build some new dorms in the next couple of years and probably tear down some existing ones. And I wanted to ask, in terms of looking at the demand for dorm space, it seems that has changed, at least as far as I can tell. Students wanting more single accommodations, wanting more bathrooms to themselves, things like that. How do you decide what you can do financially and with the space you have and with rising enrollments over the last couple of years versus what the demand might be for individual types of accommodations from students who are incoming in the next few years? How do you balance those things?
First of all, I have to tell you, we're not supposed to call them dorms anymore.
I know, residence halls.
Yeah.
They were supposed to do that 15 years ago when I was in college, and I didn't do it then either. So.
Yeah. Well, I slip all the time myself. it's not primarily a financial problem for us, because dorms essentially pay for themselves.
Sure.
And moreover, like colleges all over the country, we are more and more likely to add any new capacity, not with our own money, but with some private sector partners' money. They're happy to build it because they're pretty well assured of full occupancy or something like it. So it's not primarily a financial matter, but it is challenging to determine what the right number is, what the right capacity is, and not either undershoot or overshoot. And there's some variables there. One is how big we decide to get and believe we can get as a university. We have grown, as you and I have discussed. We might grow further, but that's a set of choices yet to be made by our trustees. Meanwhile, there's some private investment going on that's putting a lot of new capacity in. We have to weigh all that in the balance so that we don't build either one residence hall too many or get caught with one too few. So it's not primarily a financial problem unless you were to just dramatically overshoot and wind up with a bunch of empty space. Now, there are some colleges out there that we keep reading about who have wound up there, not probably because they built too much, because they've shrunk.
I've seen videos online of colleges tearing residence halls down in the last couple of years.
Yes, and we've seen accounts of them renting them out to some business or some neighboring entity. You wouldn't want to wind up there.
The space concern is interesting, though, because if you decide, you get to decide, for instance, how many square feet are in the average room, and thus how many people live in that room, 1, 2, 3, 4. So you could build a building that has nothing but single occupancy rooms, for instance, but that, you know, you're not cramming as many people in, you're not turning it into like an airline flight where everybody's packed in like sardines, but that might take more square footage to do. So, I mean, surely you're weighing those concerns.
Absolutely, and as you pointed out, student expectations have changed a little bit. The other thing that we wrestle with, maybe more than some other schools, is, as you know, we operate under the slogan as someone invented here: "Don't amenitize, academicize." There has been this trend to very, very fancy residence halls with features that students from past eras wouldn't recognize.
A trend that we've talked about in large part about across higher education, dorms, academic buildings, basketball stadiums, things like that.
That's right. We're not interested in the granite countertops as much as we are a space for study or for groups of students to meet and perhaps work upon a project together. That sort of thing is more common now. And that takes space. So when we think about a new residence hall or we talk to a partner about one, there's usually a little bit of a tussle about we want academic space, rooms perhaps for faculty to live or grad students to live where there can be a resource for the students, things like that. We're a little more inclined to that, and each time you do that, it's one less room or two that somebody could be renting.
Real quick, how quickly do you expect to make decisions on the next few residence halls you're going to build?
This spring, but it's a rolling process. But we've been working on a master plan now for the campus, and it's coming into fruition, and that's quite quite appropriately a central part of it.
All right. Well, this has been Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Mitch Daniels. Thanks, as always, for your time. We'll do it again next month. And remember, you can find these shows archived at WBAA.org. You can send questions at any time to ask@WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for the monthly conversation with Mitch Daniels comes from Purdue University Press, publishing global scholarship and popular regional work since 1960, and featuring the fifth edition of Creating Moments of Joy Along the Alzheimer's Journey, now available. More at thepress.purdue.edu.